$6 each. We could also harvest the plants continuously. I knew it would likely take many years before I figured out how to make these tilapia systems work economically. I also knew I wanted to create urban agricultural systems that were inexpensive enough to build that they were doable for ordinary people. When my staff wanted a machine to sift our compost, for instance, I decided to retrofit an old clothes dryer that had its heating unit burned out. The spinning unit still worked, so I cut out the backside of the dryer and placed a quarter-inch screen behind the spinning drum. When we shoveled the soil into the drum, the largest wood chips remained there, and the soil passed through the holes and was sifted even more by the screen. If we were going to create prototypes for growing food in inner-city neighborhoods, they had to be cost-effective. The 250-gallon tank for our first aquaculture system was donated to us from a paper mill. This tank had originally held ink, and we had given it a new life. In building our larger aquaponics system, we recycled a lot of second-hand lumber. Just as my grandmother Rosabelle had done in different circumstances during the Great Depression, I was trying to make do. I began looking for other ways to reduce my expenses. I knew that one of the biggest obstacles to growing food indoors in Wisconsin was the problem of energy. The ability to grow in greenhouses offered a chance to extend the growing season, but the costs of heating were prohibitive. Farmers in Wisconsin were often at a distinct disadvantage because of our northern climate. Grocery wholesalers wanted a consistent product year-round, and this was an impossible obstacle for most farmers, given that our planting season for row crops extended only from April to late September. My earliest winter in the greenhouses at Silver Spring Drive had set me back $30,000 in heating bills. Even with a more efficient heating system, I was still spending too much money a decade later to keep the greenhouses warm. They were not insulated very well, and the heat generated by our Modine forced air heaters was escaping out of the cracks in the glass of the roof. One thing I noticed when we got our tilapia aquaculture system up and running was that it was much warmer in the second greenhouse than in the other four greenhouses. By heating the 40,000 gallons of water in the system, we were also heating the air. This humid heat was rising from ground level, so less of it escaped out of the greenhouses. Tilapia do well in water up to 90 degrees, so by turning up the heat slightly on the water heater, we were soon able to turn off the Modine heaters entirely in the second greenhouse. As we built additional tilapia systems in other greenhouses over the next several years, we were slowly able to end our dependence on the forced air heaters. I was also looking for ways to decrease our dependence on fossil fuel. As I built my compost operation, I started receiving free wood chips from landscapers, the city of South Milwaukee, and the city of Oak Creek. Wood chips decompose slowly and give off radiant heat as they decay. By covering the floors of our greenhouses with them, I saw we could keep our greenhouses warmer in the winter. When the soil in the sprout trays was no longer fertile, we would also dump it into 4x4-foot bins in one of the greenhouses and let it compost for a while before we used it again. These bins would get as warm as 150 degrees and provide a constant heat source. Within a few years, our heating bill had declined by nearly 50%. Much of the warmth was being generated by biological activity. If other people in inner-city communities were to adapt my models for year-round growing, few would have access to large greenhouses like my own. I wanted to see if the principles worked with even less investment. In 2005, my staff and I built our first hoop house in the back lot of my property. Hoop houses are simple, low-cost greenhouses that can be built in a single day for as little as $1,000. They require little more than bent pipe, some lumber to provide support for a door, and then plastic sheets. Once we had covered the entire frame of our first hoop house with plastic, we put piles of steaming compost in each corner inside. We also covered the floor with wood chips and piled warm compost on the exterior plastic side walls. After some adjustments, we soon saw that even on days when the temperature dipped well below freezing, we could keep the hoop house heated with no electricity to more than 50 degrees. This was warm enough to grow spinach and other greens. On the days when the temperature dipped below 20 degrees, we simply covered our beds of spinach with sheets of plastic to make sure they did not freeze. Over the next several years, my staff and I built 10 more hoop houses in our back lot, allowing us to grow intensively year-round. As my staff and I worked to create a local food system and to grow food indoors, a good food movement was taking root around us. Books like Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, 2001, and Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, 2006, exposed some of the problems of our industrial food system. A new hunger for local food was being expressed throughout the country. In 1994, the year after I opened Will's Roadside, the U.S. Department of Agriculture began publishing a national directory of farmers' markets. At that time, there were fewer than 1,800 markets listed in a nation of nearly 300 million people. By 2006, there were almost 4,500. Our organization was soon the beneficiary of these larger social changes. In October of 2005, I had received a $100,000 leadership grant from the Ford Foundation that I was able to channel into the work at my Silver Spring Dry facility. Around the same time, my daughter Erica had been able to work with Heifer to establish a 19,000-square-foot community garden in Chicago, with all of the produce going to soup kitchens and shelters in the city. Mayor Daley attended the opening ceremony. Erica was also provided space by the city in Grant Park, often known as Chicago's front yard, to build an edible potager garden there. The garden was ornamental in a French style, and in it she grew 150 different varieties of herbs, edible flowers, and heirloom vegetables. Erica seeded her plants in beautiful spiral and checkerboard patterns, and they bloomed into a work of art. The project was a perfect combination of her interests in art and agriculture. She wanted to show everybody that growing food can not only have health benefits, but also add beauty to the land. With these successes also came challenges. By 2006, we were generating nearly $375,000 in gross sales, and more than twice that in grants, but our expenses still outweighed our income. I had hired several longtime volunteers, like Sarah Christman, and our staff had grown to a dozen people. I wanted to pay a living wage to my full-time employees. These salaries alone cost me more than $400,000. We also had our summer youth corps, who were compensated only a little for their work. By the time we added our truck and equipment rentals, payroll taxes, and other expenses, we were still running deficits. Growing Power's board of directors put together a strategic plan in 2006. The board was headed by a new president, Jerry Kaufman, who had retired from the urban planning department at the University of Wisconsin. He began to invest more of his energies into helping me succeed. One of our goals in the strategic plan was to continue to diversify our sources of revenue and to reduce our costs. By 2007, with the growth of our aquaponic system and our vertical growing techniques, and by trimming some of our expenses, including electricity, we were bringing in $30,000 more in revenue and grants than we were paying out. Yet this success was bittersweet. As it came in the same year, we had two personal tragedies in the lives of our staff. Karen Parker's great-nephew, 11-year-old Purvis Parker, made the national news when he suddenly went missing on an icy day in March with his best friend Quadravian Henning. The police at first questioned Purvis's father, Purvis Sr., even though all of his family knew he had nothing to do with his son's disappearance. Karen and my staff tied white ribbons on the trees along the front of our property. The community outpouring was tremendous, and it reinforced my sense of the inherent good in people. More than 200 individuals, black, brown, and white, rich and poor, most of them volunteers, were combing our community every day looking for the boys. 27 days after they went missing, on a warm day in April, their bodies surfaced in a lagoon in McGovern Park, less than a mile from our facility. Investigators determined that it was a simple accident. The boys had fallen in and been trapped under the ice. Only a month afterward came Lulu's family accident. Karen Parker cared deeply about Lulu, and she treated her as her own daughter. When Lulu was 15, Karen saw that she had fallen in with a bad crowd at a high school called South Division, and that she had too many obligations at home. Karen asked Lulu to move in rent-free to the yellow duplex across from my greenhouses and encouraged her to transfer to a different high school. Lulu accepted the offer. Lulu often wanted to do something to show Karen that she appreciated her kindness. Her parents received food stamps on Lulu's behalf, and whenever Lulu got her hands on them, she bought food for Karen as a gift. At Karen's house, Lulu and Deshaun stayed up late almost every night talking, and she fell in with a better friend group at her new school. Lulu lived with Karen from the ages of 15 to 17, but she felt an increasing obligation to help her parents and family. She was already giving her family half of her weekly check at Growing Power to help them with their rent. She moved back into their home during her senior year of high school. On May 21, 2007, Lulu was at home on West Mineral Street in Milwaukee's Clark Square neighborhood. The area houses one of Milwaukee's largest Latino populations. The average annual income in that neighborhood is less than $10,000. A week earlier, Lulu's family had their electricity shut off for non-payment. Lulu's father was dependent on insulin, which needed to be refrigerated, so a friend of their family lent them a gasoline-powered generator. Lulu's parents decided to put it in the basement. Lulu's uncle, Nolan Lopez, was also living at the house at the time. He was 54 years old and had part-time work at UPS, but the work wasn't regular. A few minutes after the family turned on the generator for the first time, Nolan went into the basement to watch a movie on a television there. Less than half an hour after her uncle went downstairs, Lulu and one of her sisters started feeling a little bit dizzy. "It feels kind of weird in here," Lulu said. Her dad noticed he was feeling strange, too. He decided to open up the basement door. As soon as he did, he began to feel even more dizzy. Lulu's father called out Nolan's name, but he did not respond. Her father could hear the engine of the generator. He decided to walk down the stairs to try to make sure Nolan was okay. Lulu and her sister followed him. When they reached the landing, they saw Nolan lying motionless on the floor. Lulu's father tried to wake him up. When he was unsuccessful, Lulu and her sister and her father began to try to drag him up the stairs. At first, Lulu thought her uncle had just passed out, but it became clear to her, as she tried to carry him, that he might already be dead. The two girls then saw that their father was having trouble keeping consciousness. Lulu and her sister decided they needed to get help. Her family could not afford to keep a house phone, so the two young women ran up the stairs and out into their yard. They started yelling to their neighbors, "Call the ambulance! Call the firefighter!" Deshaun rushed out the front door of his house that afternoon. "I'm going to Lulu's," he told his mother. "I'm going to call you when I get there." Karen asked him why, and Deshaun said that something was wrong. About an hour later, Karen's phone rang. It was Deshaun, instructing his mother to turn on Channel 12. Karen did, and there was a story on the news about two Latino men being overcome by carbon monoxide, an odorless gas, because of a generator mistakenly placed inside of the house. The reporter said that one of the men was thought to be dead. "That's Lulu's daddy and her uncle," Deshaun said. "They think her uncle's dead." Deshaun was with Lulu when he called. She had reached out to him on a friend's cell phone, and he was trying to provide her comfort. She had just been released from the hospital after getting checked for carbon monoxide in her blood. Her concentration levels were not as high as her father's. He was still undergoing treatment in a hyperbaric chamber to increase the level of oxygen in his blood. Nolan Lopez had died. Lulu's parents felt guilty after the accident. They reflected that if they would have been able to pay for electricity, they would not have needed the generator. They didn't know that you weren't supposed to bring the generator in the house. They couldn't read the warnings in English. The week after this accident, Lulu became the first of her 10 siblings to graduate from high school. She credits Karen. "I consider her like a second mother to me," Lulu says. "She'll be there to give me advice like a mother would do. I feel that if it wasn't for me staying over there, and for her thinking I should change schools, I would not have graduated. The fates of human lives are often linked, like the bonds that connect the different parts of nature. Karen's strength to stabilize her own life provided Lulu with enough stability to obtain a high school diploma. On a day after Lulu's graduation, a group of nonviolent offenders were brought to my facility to fulfill their community service hours. Karen was working in the front store when she heard a man call out her name. She turned around, but she did not recognize the man looking at her. "How do you know me?" she said. He explained. Karen had dated this man briefly, years ago, when her life was much different. She acknowledged the man, but soon retreated back into the kitchen. "I hid," she told me. "I didn't want anyone to know I knew him." Karen avoided the group the entire morning and during the visits over the next 2 days. Before her former boyfriend left on his final day at Growing Power, though, Karen gathered the courage to approach him as he was leaving. As she walked toward the man, he nudged his friend and told him, "Yeah, that used to be my girl." Karen felt sympathy for him. He was missing many of his front teeth. His eyes were sunk deeper, and he looked so much older than she remembered him. They had a brief conversation, and before leaving, he told her something quite unexpected. "I'm proud of you," he said. "I'm proud of seeing where you are today." Karen felt her own pride. She saw in this man's situation how her life could have turned out quite differently. As Growing Power gained more attention in Milwaukee, Karen had taken on new responsibilities. She often appeared on local television, describing our market basket program and our outreach projects. She could tell any customer what vegetables grew in what season and the name of every fresh thing we sold, and she had an encyclopedic memory for prices. She managed the entire Youth Corps program. She oversaw our staff, which had grown by early 2008 to a dozen people. "So many people come through here from my past," Karen said, "and they are just overwhelmed to see what I'm doing. If they glance at me on TV, or they see me here, they can't believe it. They say, 'That's Karen Parker.'" On an August morning in 2008, I was preparing to harvest lettuce on my own farm in Oak Creek when my phone rang. A man's voice I didn't recognize came on the line. He asked if I was Will Allen. I said I was. "What are you doing?" he asked. "I have my knife, and I'm getting ready to cut some salad mix," I said. "Why don't you put down that knife?" he said. "I have some good news for you." I wondered at first if this was someone I knew who was playing a joke on me. The voice seemed slightly familiar. "Have you ever heard of the MacArthur Foundation?" he said. I told him I had heard of it, but I didn't know what they did. That's when the gentleman introduced himself, and he told me that I had been named a MacArthur Fellow. It was an award for creative people who had shown originality, dedication, and self-direction. The foundation sought to make the world more peaceful and verdant. He soon explained to me the financial piece of the award, and that it offered $500,000 over a period of 5 years, and that the money was unrestricted. He asked that I tell no one but my wife until it was announced a couple of weeks later. On the day of the MacArthur announcement, in early September of 2008, I was at Kalamazoo College in Western Michigan. I had been invited to give a talk to incoming freshmen and sophomores. I was getting ready to go on stage when the person introducing me let the crowd know that I had been chosen as a MacArthur genius. As I walked onto the stage, the students rose and gave me a standing ovation. This was before I had said a word. I was surprised. I had been doing the same work for many years. It is very humbling work. The physical nature of it keeps you grounded, as well as the fact that at any point you could lose your crop. As a former athlete, I also knew that one day you could be at the very top, and on the next day, the very bottom. I had not changed, but I saw that the MacArthur Award changed how people saw me. It gave me a stamp of approval, and it validated that what I was doing was meaningful. I also could sense the pride that other African Americans felt in me as a person of color who was working in this arena. Few black people who were struggling to change the food system had received this type of validation, though poor food affects people of color more than other communities. I realized that by bringing farming and fresh food to the city, I could play a part in healing a painful rift in African American history between its agricultural past and its urban present. I could help to rebrand farming as something that could be entrepreneurial and black-owned, rather than something associated with sharecropping and slavery. I felt a deeper sense of obligation to forward the revolution in the food system in which I had now invested my life. Grit. Worms don't have teeth to digest their food, so they have to swallow soil or sand to have the right amount of grit in their gizzards. This grit grinds the sweet fruits and vegetables that they eat and helps worms break their food down. A worm cannot thrive only on sweet, soft things. Human beings need the right amount of grit. Not too much, but not too little either. As parents, we often want to protect our children from challenges, yet it can be precisely in those moments when a child faces and overcomes difficulties, when he tries and fails, but survives and tries again, that character is formed. Growing food reinforces those lessons. Farming is difficult work, and there are often setbacks. Crop losses, spoilage, insect infestations. If you persevere through these setbacks, there is still a harvest. The lessons conveyed in farming are applicable to all other areas of life. All the good things that have come in my life were only because of grit, and my willingness to forge ahead even in the face of uncertainty and mistakes. Because of the rising costs of production, the economic pressures on many small farmers have become too much to bear. If we can make small farming economically viable again, and if we can involve young people in this work, we can go a long way in teaching lessons of character that will produce more resilient and capable citizens. New frontiers. As I refined my urban farming techniques, I wanted to share our hard-earned knowledge with other small farmers. Over a period of several years, we had trained several thousand people at our workshops in Milwaukee. By 2008, we were often attracting nearly 200 people a month to our weekend training sessions. Visitors could learn composting, worm breeding, sprout production, marketing, beekeeping, and other elements of urban food production. I knew that our approach to education had limitations, though, that were primarily geographical. Most people who could benefit from learning these intensive agricultural techniques did not have the luxury to fly to Milwaukee, spend several nights in a hotel, and fly home. On Wednesday, November 5, 2008, the day after Barack Obama was elected President of the United States, I set off in a green van with some of my staff for a trip through the Deep South. We would later call it the Freedom Ride, after the famous 1960s interstate bus trips where whites and blacks tested the limits of racism and Jim Crow. There were six of us in the van, three black men and three white men, including our board president, Jerry Kaufman. We were leaving under happy circumstances, feeling pride in our first African-American president-elect. We were traveling to share our aquaponics and intensive growing techniques in Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana. We headed first to New Orleans, where we helped an urban farming project strengthen their hoop house. In the evening after we had finished our work, we held a potluck dinner on the site, where both black and white people ate together. Two of the folks were musicians, an African-American singer and young white man who played the banjo, and they played for us during the sunset as we ate okra and salad. Toward the end of the evening, the singer paused and told us, "Look, I rarely sing this song." He began to sing the national anthem. We all stood up, and many of us put our hands on our hearts. I looked over at Jerry Kaufman, whose brother had fought for civil rights, and I saw tears in his eyes. "We all started singing," Jerry remembered. minorities and whites together. There was this glorious sense of communal victory. I hope President Obama knows how good this was for us. The next day reminded us of a different reality. We were driving up Louisiana's Interstate 55 toward our second stop in Forest City, Arkansas, when our driver, Martin Bailke, a lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was helping us evaluate our programs, noticed flashing lights out of the rear window. I was asleep until the van pulled over. I was not speeding, Martin recalls. We were just in this green van, with tinted windows and Wisconsin plates on a drug route, with a white guy driving and a big black guy sitting next to the driver. The officers asked Martin to step out of the van. He gave them his driver's license, and he saw that they were drug enforcement agents. They asked Martin what we were doing and where we were going. Martin said we were an organization based in Milwaukee that trained people to create sustainable urban agriculture and community food projects. I realized, as I was talking, Martin told me later, that this wasn't making any sense to them. The two DEA agents proceeded to inspect our van. In New Orleans, I had been given a huge piece of sugarcane as a gift. We had placed it on top of the seats from front to back. The agents peered inside the hollow cane, but didn't know what to make of it. After thoroughly scouring the trunk of the van and most of our bags, they led us on our way to our workshops in Arkansas. I was not the first African-American farmer and teacher to make trips through the South to teach people how to farm. The educator and agriculturalist George Washington Carver has long served as an inspiration to me. Much of Carver's life was devoted to the cause of increasing the self-sufficiency of black farmers. My idea is to help the man farthest down, Carver said. Carver's work took many forms. He published bulletins in clear, simple language that told farmers how to use acorns for livestock feed or how to grow sweet potatoes. At the end of the 19th century, Carver also began hosting monthly agricultural seminars for African-American farmers at Tuskegee Institute, the black college in Alabama, originally founded by the educator Booker T. Washington. My workshops at Growing Power were in the spirit of Carver's own. Carver had used the occasions to demonstrate the natural fertilizers he used, including muck out of a bog on the Tuskegee campus, and teach his innovative organic growing techniques, including crop rotation. Booker T. Washington realized that most small farmers who could benefit from Carver's work could also not afford to pack up and visit Tuskegee. Washington came up with the idea of retrofitting a wagon to serve as a traveling agricultural school. Carver embraced the idea, and a New Yorker banker named Morris Jessup underwrote the project. The Jessup Agricultural Wagon first set out in 1906, and one of Carver's African-American students operated it. During the first summer, 2,000 farmers in Alabama were instructed through the traveling program. The same spirit that had guided the creation of the Jessup Agricultural Wagon prompted me, in 2004, to imagine outreach training centers for Growing Power. I wanted to create partnerships with regional organizations where we could train more people in our techniques. The idea first took root when I met Dorothy Grady Scarborough, an African-American nurse in her 50s who was trying to grow community gardens in Bolivar County, Mississippi. I met her at a conference where she was trying to build relationships to strengthen her organization, Mississippians Engaged in Greener Agriculture, or MEGA. Her goal was to improve the capacity of Mississippi farmers with limited resources to provide more food for their communities. I was working in the hospital and seeing the illnesses that were coming through, Dorothy said. My concern was, what's different now than when I was growing up? Why are these people all so sick? One of the things that came to me was that it was based on our food and how it was grown. Back then, we had a local food system. If you had a house, you had your own produce, and you had your own livestock. The lower Mississippi River Delta is home to some of the most severe health problems in the entire United States. For the 6 million African Americans who left for northern cities during the Great Migration, there are also many who stayed behind in the South. The people who live in the 240 counties that surround the Mississippi River, from southern Illinois to the Gulf of Mexico, are among the poorest and the least healthy of all Americans. A person in the Delta is nearly 25% more likely to die each year than the typical U.S. citizen. The prevalence of obesity and diabetes is staggeringly high. I gained a greater understanding for the reasons during my visit to Mound Bayou, Mississippi, Dorothy's hometown. We had come to help Dorothy and her volunteers do some strategic planning for her organization as it moved forward. Mound Bayou holds an important place in African American history as one of the prominent black towns. A dozen black men founded Mound Bayou in 1887 to better themselves and their families in an area of toxic racism. The town thrived for several decades. By 1915, the population had grown to 8,000, and Mound Bayou had 6 churches, its own post office, and several schools, both public and private. The local government was entirely controlled by black residents. Crime was almost non-existent. Booker T. Washington wrote about the community as an example of how black people could lift themselves up. When cotton prices plunged in the early 1930s, though, much of the town departed during the Great Migration. When we visited in 2008, fewer than 2,000 people were living in Mound Bayou. The average resident made less than $9,000 a year. The food environment was also very, very poor. The only grocery stores nearby were 10 miles away in Cleveland, Mississippi. The one food store in town did not have fresh fruits or vegetables. Instead, there were cans of pork rinds and cooking oil and soup and loaves of white bread. The gentleman behind the counter told me that the store was soon expanding to have a meat counter, but not a produce section. The Southern food tradition in the United States has many healthy aspects. This diet has traditionally contained a lot of dark green leafy vegetables like collard greens, yellow vegetables like squash, as well as lentils, peas, and peanuts. But much of the healthy food is fried in things like pork fat. I have seen in my trips through the South that there is a deep reliance on meat, which can often lead to colon cancer and heart disease if consumed continuously and in large portions. Meat was likely a treasure to Southern black farmers in the past, when pork and beef could only be obtained in small portions. Today, industrial beef and chicken are much less expensive, widely available, and overused. Nearly 30 chickens are killed on average each year for every man, woman, and child in the United States. The typical American consumes more than 200 pounds of meat in that same period. Fresh fruits and vegetables, on the other hand, have become scarce in some areas. Dorothy is part of a growing movement of Southerners who are trying to adjust that balance and to improve people's access to healthy food. My brother Ray is another soldier in this movement. Ray took the train with my mother from Ridge Spring to Washington, D.C. more than half a century ago. After my mother and Major Kinner split, Ray returned to South Carolina, where he has mostly lived since. In his 50s, Ray was diagnosed with asbestos-related lung cancer from his civil engineering work. Instead of chemotherapy, Ray decided to combat his illness by going completely vegetarian and eating only organic foods. Ray is now 80 years old. He is the only person he knows with his form of cancer who is still alive. He has started an heirloom seed business with 1,200 varieties that he offers through the mail. His business card reads, Ray's Organic Grown Products, consulting and specializing in heirloom, rare, and traditional plants and seeds. Victory Garden since 1941, division of Ray Kinner Company. Never go hungry. Plant a garden. The Victory Garden that Ray refers to is a tiny plot he planted as a boy after he heard Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the radio. The president had encouraged his listeners during one of his fireside chats to plant a garden to improve food security during the rationing of provisions that was necessary during World War II. Ray has since become a student of soils and of the healing power of fresh vegetables and seeds. He cultivates Kanaf hibiscus seeds for their oil, which are rich in omega polyunsaturated fatty acids. These fatty acids can reduce cholesterol and the risk of heart disease. He eats mustard greens 3 times a day. "I try to eat only what I grow," Ray told me recently. At 80, he is writing a book in longhand about natural amendments for the soil to show others how to increase the soil's fertility without chemical fertilizers. He has accumulated more than 100 pages. Both Dorothy and Ray know trade secrets that their grandparents knew. They know how flour and a bit of cayenne pepper can keep bugs away from watermelons. They know that putting a clove of garlic in the watering can help plants ward off soft-bodied insects. They are reclaiming the soil's fertility and growing food on a human scale. They possess the kind of skills that George Washington Carver taught generations ago. Their efforts also offer a protest against the destructive agriculture that treats the land as a conquest, that batters the earth with pesticides and artificial fertilizers, and that degrades not only the health of the land, but also of people. By the end of 2008, Growing Power had developed regional outreach training centers in more than half a dozen locations, from Mound Bayou to Louisville, Kentucky, to Lynchburg, Virginia. My staff and I tried to visit each training center at least once a year and conduct weekend workshops. I realized, though, that this limited training was not enough to ensure that people knew even the basics of farming, such as how to compost and seed correctly. If Growing Power were to play a part in building the good food movement, I thought we needed to provide better training to the leaders of our regional centers. In the winter of 2008, we inaugurated a commercial urban agriculture program. We asked people to come to Milwaukee over a 3-day weekend for 5 consecutive months. My goal was for the graduates of the program to know how to do everything that we did in our greenhouses and hoop houses, and to offer lessons that we had learned from nearly 2 decades of experience. A few of the early members of our commercial urban agriculture classes were from an organization called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. One of the group's founding members was Malik Yakini, a community activist from Detroit. Speaking to Malik allowed me to recognize that the challenges and possibilities of the local food movement are nowhere more evident than in the Motor City. Detroit was one of the great repositories of African American hopes during the Great Migration. In 1910, fewer than 6,000 African Americans lived there, comprising only 1% of its total population. By the early 1970s, black people accounted for nearly half of the city's 1.5 million people. Many of the initial settlers came from farms as far as Alabama when they heard of Henry Ford's 1914 promise of $5 a day, an unprecedented salary for blue-collar workers at the time. Some arrived at the Detroit train station not knowing where they would sleep, who they were going to see, or who would be interested in them, wrote John C. Dancy, who headed the Detroit Urban League, a black-led social service organization. When the train reached Detroit, they would just go into the station and sit down. While many Southern blacks looked to Detroit as a new Canaan, the reality they confronted was most often different. Restrictive housing covenants, redlining, forbade homeowners from selling to blacks in large swaths of the city. Few white-collar jobs were available. Even though Henry Ford was among the most progressive of industrialists and a friend to George Washington Carver, only a small fraction of the jobs in his plants were offered to African Americans. The black immigrants who came to the city were mostly forced to live in communities on the Near East Side, one of which was called Black Bottom. When they tried to move out into other neighborhoods, they were often greeted with violence. In the 2 decades after the Second World War, more than 200 black family homes were attacked by whites. These homes usually belonged to the first or second families to move into all-white neighborhoods, writes the civil rights historian Thomas Sugrue. Detroit's racial divisions were only made worse with the decline of the city's industrial economy and the suffering of the automotive industry. The home of the Model T and the Temptations is often considered the poster child of urban decay, says Yakini. Its population has declined by more than half in the last 4 decades. White families fled to the suburbs on the city's outer ring, while most black families in the city were hemmed in on the southern side of 8 Mile Road. Houses fell into disrepair, and the city began demolishing many of them as a way of trying to improve blight. Today, the amount of vacant land inside of Detroit, more than 20 square miles, is roughly equal to the size of the island of Manhattan. In the absence of other good options, some have wondered whether Detroit's vacant lots could be repurposed for growing fresh food. The racial and economic divisions in Detroit have created two food systems, one for the haves and another for the have-nots. More than 90% of food stamps in Detroit are spent at what the food system researcher Mary Gallagher calls fringe retailers, liquor stores, party stores, gas stations, dollar stores, and the like. More than 500,000 people in the city have to travel twice as far to reach a grocery store than a fringe store. More potato chips are consumed in Detroit per capita than in any other city in the country. These changes have had effects not only on the health of people in Detroit, but also on the city's culture. The merchants in many of Detroit's African-American neighborhoods come from an Iraqi community in the suburb of Dearborn. Both the Iraqi and the black communities inside Detroit often look upon each other with distrust. There is a phenomenon in Detroit that I call wordless transactions, Malik says. All of the convenience stores in Detroit have plexiglass to protect the merchants. The merchant sits behind plexiglass, and he might be on his telephone. You put your goods into a turnstile, and he rings them up. You see the price on a machine. You stick your money in a slot that's just big enough to put your money into. He gives you change, and not one word is exchanged. Early in 2006, Malik made a purchase at a gas station and convenience store four blocks from his house. He handed over his money, but from the merchant, there was no acknowledgment of my humanity, he said. You don't say thank you to your customers? Malik asked the merchant. The merchant cursed at him, and the two men got into a heated argument. The next day, Malik brought in a contract that he had titled the No Disrespect Pledge. Malik took it to the owner and told him, you need to read this and sign it. The letter told of Malik's experience and demanded that the merchants at the gas station treat their customers with dignity. At the bottom of the contract, Malik explained that if the owner did not sign it, Malik would share his experience with the local media. The owner cooperated. The same year of this encounter, Malik helped launch the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. He wanted to improve access to healthy food for the African-American community and to do his part in developing a better food environment in the city for people of color. In 2008, the network obtained 2 acres as a growing site in Detroit's Rouge Park, not far from Ford's giant River Rouge car factory. Malik and a dozen volunteers from the community started D-Town Farm, growing food to sell at farmers' markets and for their own consumption. I started visiting this project whenever I was in Detroit. Visitors who come to D-Town often have impromptu conversations about food and race. At a workshop I attended at the D-Town Farm in the fall of 2010, some of the participants kept warm during breaks in a finished hoop house at the north end of the farm. The group included Lila Cabell, who had been close to the civil rights icon Rosa Parks, and who is president emeritus of the Rosa Parks Institute. The conversation turned to the future of Detroit. Lila spoke about white flight from the city. Some people feel if they come back to Detroit, it's not safe for them, Lila said. What's wrong with that picture? There's no concern for the other people. So there's damage to everybody because that's not a natural human reaction, to care about yourself, your children, and not care about other children. That's why I talk about everybody's responsibility and the plight that we're in, I said. That's why we have to do this work in a multicultural way. No single group is going to solve all the problems of Detroit, Milwaukee, Flint, Buffalo, or New York City. All of these cities are suffering from the same issues. The most progress we've made in Milwaukee is by bringing people together and having them work together and by having events like today's. A young man who was still in college followed my comment by speaking about the evils of capitalism and the U.S. government. He had theories that U.S. intelligence agencies were helping to pump drugs into inner-city communities in order to keep African-American communities poor and suffering. There was a trace of condescension in the young man's comments. Lila has edited a book called Accountability and White Anti-Racist Organizing. And one of its frequent arguments is that people who do social work often consider themselves saviors of the black communities they have purportedly come to serve. She and the black elders in the community listened to the young man patiently until he said, "Detroit gets worse and worse." "We don't speak that to claim it," Lila interrupted. "You say that like it's going to happen. We want to be talking about our future in terms of what we can do about it. Just think about how we spend money on food. We continue to shop at corporate businesses, and the money quietly leaves the community," the young man said. "Yes," Lila said. "We want to get people growing their own food so that they have more power. With Obama, people voted for change, but they're sitting back waiting for him to do it. It ain't going to happen. But I can say, I can change me. If I can change me and I am part of a collective, I can be a part of creating a different outcome. But I've got to start with me." Lila paused for a moment. "The reason we're drugged the way we are is because of what we eat," Lila said. "If we were eating the right food, we wouldn't need the drugs." As growing power contributed our knowledge to efforts like D-Town in Detroit, we were also adding new pieces to our growing urban farm on Silver Spring Drive. My goal was to make my facility into a laboratory of intensive growing techniques that other organizations and commercial urban farmers could transplant into their own communities. One desire I had was to show that livestock larger than worms could peacefully inhabit an urban area. Our first animal was Oakley, a billy goat with a musky odor, whom we used to mow some of the tall grasses behind our greenhouses. We soon brought Oakley a she-goat for companionship, and he sired a number of young alpine goats that we began to keep in an enclosure in the back lot. I hoped eventually to be able to create goat's milk, but in the meantime, the animals always attracted the interest of young people who visited our facility. Once, a young boy from the neighborhood stole one of our smallest baby goats. The boy's teenage friend persuaded him that a goat would be hard to keep as a pet, paid him $5 for it, and then returned it to us safely only a few hours after it disappeared. I took it as a sign that we had developed good relationships in the community, that the young man would want to help us retrieve the goat. We also built a chicken coop and a hoop house on our back lot to raise fresh eggs. More than 90% of the eggs that we eat in this country come from birds confined in battery cages, a cruel system that provides hens little more space than the size of a piece of paper to move the entire 2 years of their lives. Our coops were without cages. I explained to our customers that happy hens made for delicious eggs. We sold the eggs in our store and at farmers' markets, and we provided some of our market baskets. Whenever I went into the hoop house with the chickens, it was always very warm. My staff and I did a little research, and we found that a single chicken produces about 10 watts just with its body heat. In the summer, the chicken house got so hot that we had to vent it well to make sure the birds could breathe. In the winter, though, I realized that the extra heat from the chickens could potentially help us grow food. My staff and I set up a hoop house that was partly devoted to chickens and partly to spinach. We put down fresh straw every day to absorb the ammonia from the chicken waste. The idea worked even better than we'd intended. We were soon growing winter spinach with chicken heat. We explored other novel ways to create energy. In 2006, we began a partnership with a compost machine manufacturer called CBT Wear Parts to build an anaerobic digester. If the digester worked properly, it would transform organic food waste into gas that could be used to create electricity. An anaerobic digester has some similarities to the digestion process of a cow. The rumen, one of the four compartments of a cow's stomach, is full of microbes that allow the animal to digest food. There are more bacteria in a single cow's rumen than there are people who inhabit the entire earth. These billions of microbes quickly consume the small amount of oxygen in the rumen, so the food that enters is ultimately broken down anaerobically, without oxygen. When organic waste is digested without oxygen, it produces methane gas. In the atmosphere, methane turns into carbon dioxide and contributes to global warming. In an anaerobic digester, you put organic waste in a sealed environment. Add some acetic acid to digest the waste and capture the methane that is released. The methane can then be cleaned and used as a heating gas, or diverted into an engine that can convert the gas to electricity. The gas also can be stored until you need it, a clear advantage over solar or wind power. The sludge that is left over is often rich in nutrients like phosphorus and potassium and can be used as a fertilizer for plants. There is potential with organic waste for energy production. At least 1/4 to a half of the fresh food that we create in this country is thrown out before it is eaten. Enough food waste, as the author Jonathan Bloom has pointed out, to fill the Rose Bowl in Pasadena every day. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that wasted food is one of the largest producers of methane in the United States. According to one estimate, if we were somehow able to gather all of this wasted food, trap its released methane, and convert the methane into energy, we could power nearly 1 out of every 20 homes in this country. With the help of a grant from the state of Wisconsin and funds from the U.S. Department of Energy, CBT Ware Parts built a digester in our back greenhouse. The main piece was a 10,000-gallon cylindrical tank. In 2008, during our first successful test of the system, we shoveled food waste into the tank, sealed it, and then heated the tank to nearly 100 degrees to aid in the digestion. The machine worked as intended, and we were able to capture dozens of cubic yards of gas, which we stored. We hope in the coming years to develop enough relationships to process more organic waste, convert the gas to electricity, and have the machine running full-time. If we are going to be able to make urban farms economically viable in the future, we are going to have to figure out how to create inexpensive renewable energy. We need energy sources that don't place insupportable burdens on the environment and people, as fossil fuels do. The troubling reality is that our current models for alternative energy, solar and wind power in particular, are not powerful or efficient enough to replace coal and oil altogether. Bill Gates has said that if he had one wish to improve the fate of human beings over the next half century, it would be for an energy miracle. He wants something that could produce the same energy as coal without carbon emissions, and at half the price. Anaerobic digesters are not that miracle, but I see them as one of many stopgaps until we figure out Gates' dream. With the help of Wisconsin Energy Corporation, the local utility in Milwaukee, I have also been able to install solar panels at Growing Power to help heat our water systems. In addition, we have partnered with the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, who provided a grant of $35,000 to create a rainwater catchment system. It now captures most of the rainfall on our greenhouse rooftops and redirects it into our fish systems. My intention in time is to build a facility that is entirely off the grid and that uses only the power of the sun, the earth, and decaying waste to grow food. I'm not there yet, but I believe I can make it happen. All of these innovations at Growing Power came from relationships. I could not grow my compost without companies that were willing to provide their organic waste to me. The work of creating renewable energy required me to develop lasting partnerships with utilities and machine companies. I did not have a market for my products without building a reliable customer base at restaurants, cooperatives, and farmers' markets throughout the city. Industrial farming has disrupted these kinds of relationships, and it has torn at the fabric of communities. We now had the hopes of Milwaukee invested in Growing Power. Milwaukee's progressive mayor, Tom Barrett, asked our staff in 2009 to plant a garden at City Hall, and we were glad to do it. Mayor Barrett's initiative came in the wake of the good work of Michelle Obama, whose demonstration garden at the White House has, I believe, inspired many more Americans to plant gardens at their own homes. As our capacity to do work throughout Milwaukee became greater, I also began to form relationships with several corporations in the city. One of Wisconsin's best-known homegrown businesses is Kohl's, which runs 1,000 department stores throughout the country. Their corporate office, just a few miles north of my facility, was a gleaming building of black glass and white marble that was home to more than 3,000 employees. Kohl's had a volunteer program, and they began to partner with us by sending 5 employees a week to work for several hours along.